Counsel, my name is Mark Dabowski. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Michael Mars. This case is an illustration that words matter, and perhaps even the capitalization of letters matter. It's clear from the ruling of the court below that the court felt compelled to rule the way it did on account of the discretion accorded to Motorola. However, the limits of discretion in interpreting ERISA plans set forth in this court's Qual versus Ameritech ruling, Motorola's conflict of interest, and a conflict with other circuits compels reversal of the court below. The clause at issue in this case, Section 12.3 of the Motorola Disability Plan, is clearly not the model of draftsmanship. However, the clause is clear enough when considered with the other clauses in the Motorola Disability Plan, the Health Plan, and the Pension Plan to indicate that the rights conferred on Michael Mars at the time that he became disabled could not be diminished by amendment of the plan. The Qual case set forth a very common sense manner in which to disambiguate the ambiguity and to consider the deference to be accorded to a plan administrator or plan sponsor in interpreting a plan. The court set forth that deference is relative to the nature of the issues, including their complexity. The more complex, the greater the range of reasonable resolutions. When guides to meaning, parenthesis, wording, commonsensical principles of interpretation, and commercial background, end parenthesis, line up
but
on
I
one...
But I don't see that. Looking at this language with respect to periods of disability prior to the adoption day, I don't see how that helps you.
I think it does, Your Honor, because of where the prior is placed in the clause at issue, particularly
where the what?
Where the word prior is placed in the clause, particularly in view of how the lower court interpreted the clause.
Well, I don't know how
issue.
That helps you. It's confining periods of disability to prior to the amendment.
But
where
a period
does that help you?
But a period of disability, Your Honor, under the explicit terms of this agreement, is a continuous period beginning with the initial date of disability. And even if we were to put aside whether the P in period is capitalized or not and whether it becomes a defined term under the policy, the term disability is a clearly defined term in the policy. And common sense dictates that a period of disability is a continuous period. Michael Mars never experienced a remission of his disability such that he would be subject to change.
Why is your interpretation any superior to one that says that they can't pull back benefits that have been awarded with respect to, you know, disability, his disability experiences prior to the adoption date, the amendment?
Because that interpretation, Your Honor, defies common sense. I mean, the clawback issue is just a matter of common sense that once the benefit is paid out, there are specific provisions in this plan allowing the plan to recover an overpayment, Section 11.4.
Right.
None of those provisions would apply to a situation
where
there's an
amendment.
No, but
I mean, this says, one interpretation is they can't retroactively reduce your benefits. They can't take your benefits away.
Well, I think if
that have already accrued because they accrued before the amendment, right?
Well, perhaps the guide to this may come from the Second Circuit in the Pfeiffer ruling.
Well, I doubt it. Why don't you just answer directly? What's to prevent this from being interpreted just to mean that if the amendment occurs on January 1st and they haven't paid you yet for your disability in December, they can't not pay it. That's accrued because you were disabled, you know, as on the date of the amendment.
But that's one interpretation.
Yeah, that's one interpretation. Why is that any inferior to your interpretation? Why aren't they equally plausible or implausible?
Because that interpretation would be more plausible had there not been any statement in the plan the equivalent of Section 12.3. If there were silence, then this...
I don't understand you. We're talking about 12.3.
I understand that. But the rule in this circuit is that the presumption against vesting exists when the plan is silent. In this case, the plan is not silent.
I'm not talking about presumptions. I'm just asking you, why can't this just be interpreted to mean that if your entitlement to benefits has accrued, they can't, by amending the plan, take those accrued benefits away from you?
Because the plan provision standing in itself couldn't possibly mean only that.
Why?
Because they would not have indicated that an amendment shall adversely affect the rights of participant to receive benefits with respect to periods of disability. A period of disability is a continuous period. Anybody participating in this plan would have an understanding that the terms of the plan as they existed on the day they became disabled would remain the terms of the plan throughout their disability under this wording.
You're not responding to my... Why isn't this just... I mean, this is your periods of disability, but why not? Why couldn't this just mean, yes, you were disabled prior to the amendment... Those were your periods of disability prior to the amendment, and the amendment can't take away the benefits you were entitled to for those periods before the amendment, right?
Perhaps we're not communicating with each other, but what I've been trying to explain to the court is that because of the terminology in this provision, periods of disability, with the word prior coming after that, not prior periods of disability, that interpretation makes far less sense and is a strained interpretation, particularly...
So it's periods that you're focusing on?
Periods is an important terminology term, Your Honor, but the word disability in the plan is defined as an ongoing continuous inability to engage in work. So the disability began earlier, and that's why I wanted to go back to the Pfeiffer case earlier, because the Pfeiffer case gives the example of if a plan had unfettered discretion to be amended in this manner.
But this person, your client, had periods of disability, years of disability, prior to the adoption of the amendment, and any benefits that accrued to him during that period the amendment can't take away. Why is not a permissible reading?
Because the disability is ongoing.
There are periods of disability prior to the amendment and subsequent to the amendment.
There's
right?
but one period of disability so long as the individual remains disabled. I think that's where we're disconnecting,
Your
Honor.
No, I mean, I don't understand.
Well,
what if it said years of disability? If it said years of disability prior to the adoption date, then the natural reading would be, any disability before the any benefits that accrued before the amendment are vested.
The reason that interpretation does not make sense, Your Honor, is because it would then leave the plan free to cut the benefit in half or take away the benefit altogether.
Yes.
And that is what creates the problem with interpreting the provision in that respect. And that was the situation that Pfeiffer pointed out.
That's what an amendment does. It takes away benefits.
For instance.
An amendment can certainly take away benefits, but somebody who becomes disabled has no right of self-protection after they become disabled. If, let's say, I was an employee of Motorola, and I had been working there, and I got a bulletin from the benefits department saying, from here on, we are going to amend our benefit plan to reduce certain benefits. At that point, I have the right to decide, I don't want to work at Motorola anymore. The business across the street has a much better plan in the event that I become disabled. The whole purpose of this plan is to provide income protection.
But these companies are constantly terminating health benefits for retirees. They don't have any options.
And as those cases illustrate, Your Honor, the right to terminate those plans is dependent on the plan language. And the plan language here...
Well, we've said there's a presumption against lifetime benefits.
That's correct. but that presumption can be overcome by plain
language.
Yeah,
but I don't see how your interpretation is superior to the alternative.
Because of Mr. Mars's situation, because of the Second Circuit rulings, the Pfeiffer, the Gibbs ruling.
Why is his situation different from that of a retiree?
His situation isn't different from that of a retiree, but in a retiree situation, in retiree situations that this court has faced before, many of those cases, all of those cases, have turned on whether the plan has properly reserved the right to amend. And if there's limitations on the right to amend, then this court has found that either the amendment or the elimination of retiree health benefits is unlawful.
And also, isn't there a specific provision that does vest the benefits of people who became disabled before 1994?
There is, Your Honor.
Well, doesn't that undermine your position?
We don't feel that that undermines our position at all, because it doesn't affect the people who became disabled after 1994 and before this 2003 amendment. The provision of Section 12.3, we haven't seen every single iteration of this benefit plan, but the provision of Section 12.3 when Mr. Mars became disabled and the provision of Section 12.3 as it exists today, both would limit an adverse amendment that would diminish Mr. Mars' rights under this plan. And that's the position that we've been taking in this case. That's the position of the Second Circuit. That's the position of the Eighth Circuit. That's the position of the Ninth Circuit. Only this court has come to a different conclusion and reached the type of interpretation that differs substantially from the interpretation of those other circuits. So we do have a circuit conflict, and perhaps this is an occasion where this circuit can invoke the tiebreaker of the conflict of interest, since Motorola was acting under a conflict of interest and acted in their own favor. The conflict of interest, according to the Supreme Court, is a factor that must always be taken into consideration. And Motorola adopting this interpretation when they chose on another occasion to say to Mr. Marsh, well, you began a period of disability earlier, so we're not going to give you the benefit of the amendment that occurred later, there's an inconsistency, and that type of inconsistency is the type of factor that other courts have identified, specifically the Booth versus Walmart case in the Fourth Circuit, as indicative of an abuse of discretion. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Dabowski. Mr. Murray.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is John Murray, and I represent the appellees in this case, Motorola, and three of its employee benefit plans. There are three decisions that are on appeal here today. Two of them were on motions to dismiss. One was on cross motions for summary judgment. The motions to dismiss the anti-cutback claim under Section 204G of ERISA and Section 510 interference under ERISA are both dead on arrival in our view, because they run directly into authority from this circuit that is controlling. In the case of the 204G claim, Arndt versus Security Bank makes clear that the expectation of accruing additional service during one's disability in the future is not protected by Section 204G. It is not accrued. It only accrues as you spend time on disability, and it is not a retirement, an early retirement type subsidy. The 510 claim similarly runs into direct contrary authority from this court in McGath versus Auto Body North Shore. In that case, the court held that Section 510 does not reach plan amendments, that it only applies to actions taken in the employment context that have the effect of impeding one's ability to receive benefits.
And people's benefits under this plan, can someone's benefits be terminated because he recovers from his disability? Or they?
Yes. If all of the plans at issue here define the right to receive benefits during disability as continuing only for so long as the employee continues to be disabled. So if he were to recover, those benefits would cease. Mm-hmm. And that is another contingency that could cause that accrual not to occur in the future, is if there were a recovery. So that leaves just the 502A1B claim, the denial of benefits claim. And it's important to remember that the question before the court on this claim is whether the plan administrator abused its discretion in construing Section 12.3 of the plan as permitting the application of the MNAD amendment to Mr. Mars in this case. And that question is simply whether there was a rational basis for the decision that the administrator made. We believe that there is absolutely a rational basis. In fact, Mr. Mars's reading requires the court to conclude that there was a typographical error in the plan. We don't believe there's any basis for drawing that inference. As Judge Posner pointed out, the language of Section 12.3 is very readable as is. It makes perfect sense that it was intended to protect the benefits that should have that would have been payable in for past periods prior to the amendment. There are any number of reasons why there could be those situations. First, there's the fact that the amendment on January 1st may come before the check has been sent out for December. Another possibility is that somebody may have a claim up on appeal, for example, and it may be some months later when we finally determine that they were eligible for benefits in that prior time frame. And so in that situation, the amendment would protect the plan, would protect the beneficiary or the participant against a clawback of benefits that had not yet been paid for that prior period but are now determined to be due. There's also the plaintiff makes much of the structural conflict of interest in this case. And Mr. Dubofsky just suggested that the court should apply a tiebreaker in this case if it's close. And I think it's important to remember that while Glenn, the Supreme Court's decision in Glenn did talk about conflict of interest as being a tiebreaker, it's important to understand that the tiebreaker is when the question of abuse of discretion is in equipoise, that the conflict of interest would be a tiebreaker. It's not when the decision on the merits of the participant's claim for benefits is a close call that the conflict of interest should be a tiebreaker. In this case, there's lots of reasons to find that the administrator's reading of Section 12.3 was perfectly logical. First of all, it's consistent with the plan's rules of construction. Periods of disability does not have a capital P. Period of disability, the defined term, does have a capital P and a capital D. And I should note, disability by itself is a defined term. So the capitalization of the D and with the coupling it with a small case P does not necessarily mean that there's an illogical capitalization of the disability.
What is the definition of period with a capital P of disability?
It's in Section 2.19, Your Honor, and I'm not certain that I have it here. But interestingly, the definition of period of disability, which is essentially, in essence, what it says.
Oh,
is
no,
that,
I see it.
Okay.
I see it.
And interestingly,
one or more periods of absence from active employment due to disability.
Yes, and I believe that the definition of the term actually uses a lowercase p to describe period as an interval of time. So the notion that the period has no meaning unless it's coupled with disability as a period of disability is simply not logical. As Judge Posner pointed out, Section 1.1 specifically preserves benefit levels for people who became disabled prior to 1994, and that provision would be rendered meaningless by a reading of Section 12.3 that precludes the amendment for anybody who is already disabled when the amendment is adopted. And it also shows that the plan's drafters knew how to write a provision that way and evidently didn't intend that in this case. So for all these reasons, we believe that the reading the administrator gave makes perfect sense. I want to briefly address the point that Mr. Dubofsky just made about a different decision being made with respect to an increase in benefits. I think it's important to note that the amendment that increased benefits was very clear that it would only apply to people whose disabilities commenced after the amendment. So that this is not a question of construing the same language in two different ways. Rather, it's a question of construing two different terms or two different kinds of language, each according to its logical import. So for all these reasons, if there are no further questions, the defendant appellees believe that the decisions below should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Anything further, Mr. Dubofsky?
Just very briefly, because I didn't have an opportunity to address the anti-cutback, bless you, Your Honor, the anti-cutback and the 510 violation in my opening argument. The Arndt case certainly does appear to be similar to this case, but the case is distinguishable because in Arndt there was no provision such as 12.3 that limited the plan's right to amend. With respect to the 510 violation, the McGath case is also distinguishable. The employment relationship in this case was affected, and McGath was issued prior to the
ruling. I don't understand. How is the employment relation affected?
The McGath case was issued prior to the Rhodes versus Illinois Department.
How is the employment relation affected?
Because it constituted an adverse employment action.
I don't understand. But that would be true in any case where benefits were changed, right?
That's potentially true, Your Honor.
But that would overrule a zillion cases which permit amendments that terminate non-vested rights.
One aspect of an adverse employment relationship.
Well, is that what you're contending for?
No, I'm not asking this court to reverse a host of other
cases.
No,
I don't understand you. If your view is that anything that affects benefits alters the employment relationship, then companies couldn't terminate non-vested benefits.
Absolutely not. Because
what's the distinction?
The distinction is whether 510 is an available cause of action or not.
Now you've lost me completely. What's the difference between the ordinary case where employer terminates non-vested benefits and this case?
In the ordinary case, the plan administrator may have a valid economic reason, which would be a defense to a 510 action.
Oh, no. That's never been imposed as a requirement. If you have a reason for terminating, no, they just do it. And as long as it's non-vested, there's no recourse. Unless, you know, the contract says you have eternal benefits. So you're making a very radical argument.
I don't think it's that radical, Your Honor, because this decision was aimed.
Well, yes, you're saying that a company can't, a plan can't cut non-vested benefits without an economic reason.
Well, the two responses I have to that are, number one, this was a vested benefit.
That's not an answer. Because if it was a vested benefit, then the plan protects if you don't need the anti-cutback rule. Right? So what's your second response?
The second response has just left my mind, but I see my time has expired.
You can always answer a judge's question.
That's okay.
If I can recall what the answer was.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dubofsky. The case is taken under advisement.
Saved by the bell.